Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu with him. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode is with Nick Hawkes. I've known Nick for a while now, and let me tell you a little bit about Nick. So Nick was one half of Kicks Like a Mule, that had the chart bothering hit The Bouncer. Nick was also one of the co-founding partners and set up XL Records. Nick also set up Positiva Records. Nick manages Liam Howlett. He's literally ticked every major box in the music industry. So he's somebody that I love chatting to. He's got so many great stories, and you're going to hear a fair few of them today. And what I should say as well, he's also a great podcaster. Him alongside former guest Eddie Temple Morris run the Trailblazers podcast, which if you like this podcast, you will love that podcast. I won't tell you too much about it because Nick will tell you as this podcast unfolds anyway. And what I should say is we recorded this podcast during lockdown, and there was a little glitch with the recording my end, which means we've used the first 10 minutes of the Zoom audio, and then by the time Nick gets into telling us what his first song choice is, it's back to the two audio feeds, so it drops back into a much better quality recording once we get the hellos out of the way. Also, before we get on with the episode, I'd like to say a big thanks to 76 for producing this podcast and kind of making it all sound great for years. And big thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody over at the Distraction Pieces Network. Okay, if you enjoy this episode and it's your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, go and have a look in the archive, because there's about 120 episodes with some of your favourite musicians, producers, actors, comedians, artists. Go and have a rummage in the archive. Okay, let's get on with it. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Nick Hawkes. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing, www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fairwear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast, and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whippin.
Okay, welcome to Off The Beaten Track podcast. Joining me today via the means of Zoom in lockdown is co-founder of XL Records, founder of Positiva Records, music manager, finder of The Prodigy, and most importantly, Trailblazers podcaster, which we will be talking about all of these things in the duration of this podcast. Hello, Nick Hawkes.
Hey, how you doing, mate? You all right?
Yeah, good. So we've not seen each other for a few months, or I don't think anyone's really seen anyone for a few months, have they?
That's right, apart from over the interwebs, you know, and it's just not the same, though, is it, really?
No, it's really not. I mean, I'm looking behind you at the moment, and it look, from what I can see over your shoulder, Nick, it looks like my bedroom in 1989.
Well, that's one of the advantages of more time at home, basically. I've got a big plastic bag that's been disintegrating, that's been stuffed full of flyers and posters and stuff like that over the years. Never got time, chance to do anything with them, really. I've DJed, you know, quite a lot over the years, although, you know, maybe not at a really high profile sort of level, but I run this club night now with my best friend Andy called Reach Up. And then over the years, there's been a whole bunch of Positiva bits and stuff under the name Hawks for a little while, and a lot of XL bits. So all of these flyers just go in this plastic bag. And then, you know, being at home all the time, I actually managed to fish these things out. And instead of a blank wall behind my decks in my sort of music room at home now, yes, you can see a whole bunch of sort of flyers and posters that I've stuck up, which are, you know, maybe 30 years worth of gigs and events that I've been to. So you can see various bits. Yeah, Prodigy posters and bits with Positiva logos in Israel and New York and Canada. And yeah, I've been very lucky, really, Steve.
Well, Nick, how have you found, I mean, you just said that you've traveled the world as a DJ and obviously as a label boss and such, and how have you found all of a sudden being confined to your home?
Well, you know, the one thing that we do have a bit of control over is you know, how we perceive things ourselves. We can work on viewing the world around us as having opportunities or as having lots of threats and challenges, and the reality is it's both. But I suppose I've had a mixed bag of emotions, as probably we all have. But I guess I've tried to view it as an opportunity to rest up a bit in a way, in the sense that I've spent 30 years kind of in and out of clubs sort of most weeks. So it's probably been the longest period since I was maybe 15 or something without setting foot inside a nightclub. So maybe that's a good thing, a bit of a rest and a bit of a break from that scene, a bit of a recharge of the batteries.
Do you feel like, because I'm very much the same as you, obviously I run a nightclub and it's the longest I've, as you were saying that then, I was just thinking, wow, yeah, this is the longest I've never been in a nightclub, because I'm still there every week. But what I want to know is, because, you know, you spin a lot of plates, as a businessman, and And what I'm interested in is something that I've sort of struggled with, having a few different bits and pieces on the go in lockdown. Is, are you able to kind of allow yourself, like, you know, an afternoon, and just go, oh, do you know what, I'm just gonna watch TV this afternoon? Are you comfortable with that, or do you feel guilty for that and feel you should be doing something work wise? Because I find if I stop for lunch, I'll put the TV on and just have a sandwich and I watch TV. And the minute I finish that sandwich, I think, right, I've got to carry on. And I haven't in reality. Yeah. And I just wonder how you deal with that. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, when the whole thing sort of started, like many people, I thought, oh, right, so there's an opportunity here to do the things that I've not done, and maybe I can learn a new language and blah blah blah, all that sort of stuff. The reality is I haven't learned a big new skill. It's not like I'm going to come out of lockdown going, oh yeah, I can speak Mandarin now. No, it's not happening. Nice idea, but no. So I would say that there's still quite a lot of work stuff flying around. Even though the artists I manage are not touring, there's still a whole bunch of communication flying around, people making records and doing stuff and making things happen. So I would say that I certainly haven't felt at any point kind of like I've maxed out the things that I can do. I mean, I hear people say, oh yeah, I've watched everything on Netflix, so, you know, I don't think there's anything more to watch because I've done every series. Go, I'm certainly not in that category. So I've continued to work, I've continued to be pretty busy. And on the guilt thing, do I sort of find myself feeling guilty? I mean, I haven't had many afternoons where I have just watch TV and done nothing, because there's usually other stuff flying around. But if I do spend a bit of time doing non-work stuff, then I don't feel guilty about it. But I suppose what I would feel is that if I'd just been chilling for, you know, the afternoon and not looked at email, I'm sure I would then feel, come 11 p.m. or midnight, I'll be like, yeah, I need to kind of get back across email. And then I'd probably spend a couple of hours working. So, but the fortunate thing is that I do enjoy what I do. So whilst it is work, it is, you know, I do enjoy it. So it doesn't necessarily feel like, oh God, you know, this is such a terrible thing. I've got to jump on email at midnight. Yeah. This is awful. Because I'm engaging, you know, I like working with artists and I like being involved in helping records to emerge and all of that kind of thing. So, yeah, you know, there are definitely people who have been more radically affected by the whole lockdown thing than myself. I mean, the economics for everybody who's involved in artists who tour or club or run clubs, that certainly is massively affected. So, I mean, I mentioned the Reach Up night that I do earlier. So that's at the Bussey Building in South London, traditionally monthly. And then myself and Andy had about six gigs lined up, I think, on consecutive weekends. We had Dublin, Manchester, Glasgow, Dundee, somewhere else. And for us, those just all, you know, disappeared. So obviously, just on that one, a major impact. Yeah.
As a fellow DJ and promoter, you know, the one thing that seems to be the thing that's currently, constantly being sort of said to me is, well, you have to understand that your industry is probably going to be right at the back of the queue when it comes to things starting again. It's like, yes, you know, obviously there's going to be major sporting events and things like that, but gigs, clubs, festivals, you know, it's huge amounts of people in confined spaces. So, you know, no, I can't see there being a quick fix to that.
there isn't a quick fix. And I do wonder what the shape of it all will be as and when it does return, yeah. And how different it may be to what we've known before.
Absolutely.
And it is a concern. But I try to, yeah, I mean, I try to look at the world around me and draw out what positives I can.
I think it's a very important thing to do, mate.
Yeah, and I think I've always probably been fortunate in that I've always probably been orientated towards that, or tried to do that where I can. And we will just, you know, we've got to take it a day at a time and see where it lands. I mean, I think the music industry will, you know, there will be people who won't be able to continue being full-time artists because they just will have to do something else to keep afloat. People who had relied, who maybe were recording artists, but relied completely on gig income to pay the rent rather than recorded income. A whole bunch of those people will have to do something else, or will have to modify. I mean, we'll see paid for streams, live streams, kind of starting to have more profile. But, you know, the level of income that they'll generate and what kind of artist you need to be to earn significantly for paid for gig streaming, all questions that are yet to be answered, you know.
Okay. Well, let's get on with today's playlist.
And sure.
Nick, I will start obviously with track one, and track one is the song with the greatest ever intro.
Yeah, well, this is difficult because there are lots of records with great intros. But the reason I picked the record that I've picked is because I have a very clear memory when I was in my teens of hearing this record. And at the time I heard it, the whole record, not just the intro, but the whole record, I thought was basically the best record ever made. And I thought, how can any other record ever be better than this? It's just the pinnacle. It sounds exciting and dynamic and futuristic and funky and edgy, and it ticks all the boxes for me. And when the intro of this record starts, and whenever I hear it again, it takes me back to being a teenager growing up in Portishead, which is just outside Bristol on the coast, down there in the southwest. And I hear it again and I think, wow, I'm blown away by the emotions that hearing great music, yeah. Triggers, if you like. I picked a record called Hip Hop Bebop Don't Stop by Man Parish.
So what I want to ask, which I ask musicians this, and let's not overlook the fact that you was a musician, but what I'm more interested in is you in the sort of label side of things. And,
yeah.
and the sort of A&R mind that you've got. In regards to intros, so, you know...
Excuse me, sorry. One second, Stu. I just got to have another cough. One second, mate. Right, I feel much better now. Thank you. Sorry.
Good to go, mate. So, I mean, the track you chose is kind of early, sort of electro, sort of early doors of hip-hop, really, I guess.
Yeah.
And in regards to maybe... sort of hip hop and definitely the early sort of stages of dance music that you was involved with, that the early rave scene, and right the way through to the work that you still do with Liam,
yeah.
and a prodigy, like,
yeah.
intro, the intro, especially from the A&R point of view, like, how key is intro in the music genres that you work in? Because dance music is historically kind of tailored towards DJs in areas, and there's not them instant rock and roll beginnings that intros. Whereas with dance music, sometimes is tailored towards the DJ to allow mixing and stuff like that. What did you look for, and what do you look for, and how have you seen the changes in intros in music?
I mean, you want something ideally that both grabs you, so it instantly excites you and engages you, but also hints that something else really interesting and exciting is going to happen. I mean, the easiest intros for club DJs to mix are boring as hell to listen to just as a regular punter, 16 bars of 4/4 beat, you know, if it's a house record, or 16 or 32 bars of some kind of break beat rolling along. If it's, you know, if we're going back to rave records, you know, the best DJ records were easily mixable, and something that's easily mixable is not necessarily going to be the most interesting listen. So you've got functional kind of intros on records, which help DJs to support them. And then you've got intros to records that are just designed to be interesting, engaging, dynamic, and all the rest of it. I mean, really, in terms of making great records, the best records aren't ones where the producer has thought, let me make this easy, let me make it functional. That doesn't necessarily make the best record. It helps to get a record played, but it doesn't help make the best record. So you know, I'm looking for all bits of you know, a record, a track, or if I'm listening to a demo from an artist who, you know, is interested in me working with them management wise, or I consult and help new artists now. Also, I do some kind of one-to-one consultancy with developing artists, and sometimes artists say, hey, you know, can you listen to my tracks? And I try and figure out if I can help them. You know, I'm saying to them, just make the best music that you can make, and make something that's engaging and dynamic and interesting and says something. So I think that in the general sort of record making space, I'm encouraging artists to put their best foot forward, if you like, rather than think too much about how do I package this up in a sort of functional manner. I think artists need to know where they sit in the ecosystem. So I think that's useful. So if I'm speaking to a new artist and I say, hey, kind of, I might sometimes say, hey, if I've not heard your music, who might you be categorized next to? Hey, if you like Amy Winehouse and you like Joss Stone, you might like Artist X. I think it's useful for an artist to have that kind of understanding of where their, you know, where their audience may be. But equally, just do your thing, make great records. Hopefully, if you've got something to say, say it well, say it coherently, say it with confidence. And even if it's a theme that's been explored before, let's see if you can say it in a way that's a little bit different to the ways that it's been said before. And these are the kind of areas of encouragement and advice that I give to artists that I'm working with.
I think that's probably the best that question's ever been answered, Nick.
Oh, well, thanks. That's good to hear.
Excuse me. Mm. Nick, track two, the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Yes. So we go further back with this one than Porter's Head days. This one takes me back to watching Top of the Pops as a kid. When I used to live in Loughborough in Leicestershire in the Midlands, And I watched Top of the Pops, and Top of the Pops was the big thing. So one night of the week that everybody watched music television, and whatever you saw on that show would be the big talking point in schools up and down the land, and, you know, work cafes and workplace hangouts or whatever. It was a big, you remember it, Stu, it was a big thing, right?
It can't be understated how huge that program was, how important that program was, how much of a talking point and how influential that was, because music television didn't exist. And it was like you got what was available, and that was the moment. Half hour, Thursday nights, Top of the Pops.
That was it. And of course you didn't have the internet, so you couldn't just go and be exposed, just go online and tap it into, you know, into new interesting music easily. If you were either watching Top of the Pops or you were listening to cassettes or bits of vinyl that you'd purchased or that you'd raided from your older brother's room or what have you, that was how it rolled. And this pop group, Sweet, were the first pop group that really had an impact on me. And interestingly, they were also the first pop group that I actually kind of saw sort of in person. Now, not at a gig, but my brother took me to Loughborough University, and Sweet were playing one evening there, and I was maybe 7 years old, six, seven, I'm guessing, around about that era. But he took me down there just to have a look about, if you like, in the sort of late afternoon after school, when the band was sort of turning up for a sound check, and I sort of caught a bit of their presence. They turned up in a cool looking tinted windows kind of car, and they did their sound check and they shot off again, and I just was touched by a bit of pop star sizzle and glamour, and oh, that kind of looks exciting. But I was very, very young,
and he looked like a rock star, didn't he?
Yeah, that was Brian Connolly was the lead singer, and they all, you know, they all were over the top. It was an era of glam rock and everything was big and impactful. The glam rock acts were not subtle. They were in your face and all that. And so the single that really touched me and excited me, and then became the first single that I remember going to buy as a 7-inch in Loughborough Market, was Teenage Rampage by The Sweet.
What a great name for a song for a young lad to buy, Teenage Rampage. What more do you want as a young boy?
Yeah, exactly. And obviously way off my teens at that point, but thinking, all right, yeah, this is what it's all about, is it? You know, a kind of exciting world, I suppose, of that I wasn't yet, that I didn't at that age have access to. And you're right, a great song title. And again, just something that made me think, wow, this whole thing is very interesting and exciting and dynamic.
So that emotion would have been like sort of wonder and excitement and...
Yeah, it would have been all of those things. Wonder, excitement, maybe, you know, priming some kind of imagination or anticipation about what this whole thing was about, music and performances and gigs. So obviously when you're 6-7 years old, you don't really know what a gig is. You've not been in that sort of environment. But I suppose I was starting to imagine what it might be like at that age. And then fortunately, by having this sort of chance to just catch a bit of the vibe of the band arriving to do a sound check and then disappearing off. Bizarrely, I guess my first interaction with a pop star, or, you know, or close presence to pop stars, wasn't being a paying punter and watching the gig. Funnily enough, it was slightly a little bit different to that. It was a little bit more behind the scenes-y sort of sound checky. And that's perhaps interesting when you look at my development, that, that then I went on to be a little bit, you know, more behind the scenes kind of guy. So I don't know.
Well, I want to touch on something that you just mentioned there, behind the scenes, but you was also part of the scene as well. If we're talking about the early days of rave culture.
Yeah.
And going back to Top of the Pops, did you get to perform on Top of the Pops?
I did.
Come on, how was that? I want to know all about that.
Well, I've actually been on Top of the Pops twice, funnily enough. Nice. Yeah. So once...
Are you going to spoil the magic?
Well, no. I mean, I'll tell you, the what I remember most about Top of the Pops was that the week that The Bouncer by Kicks Like a Mule, which is a record that myself and Richard Russell made together, the record, the week that that was kind of high enough in the chart for us to be invited on Top of the Pops, I think it was maybe number seven or something that week, was also a week that we had a record out by an act that I had signed called Dream Frequency, who had signed to the City Beat label. So the Bounce, even though essentially I was primarily involved in kind of running XL at that, at this point, the Bouncer didn't come out on XL, it actually came out on Rebel MC's Tribal Bass label. But yes, what I remember well about Top of the Pops was that not only was I there as an artist, but there was also another artist there that I'd signed and kind of A&R'd and helped them get their records together, Dream Frequency. So the day was unusual for me because I sort of flipped between artist mode, and then I'd go and see the act that I'd signed, who were also playing on Top of the Pops that day, and I'd be saying things like, yeah, it looks good, but maybe should we shift the keyboards over a bit, and maybe the dancers can maybe be a little bit more up front, kind of. So yeah. I was flick-flacking a little bit between behind the scenes kind of record label guy mode and artist. So that, I mean, maybe that's enough, that it's possibly quite unusual to have both of those experiences on the same Top of the Pops day.
Spinning plates even back then, Nick. Hello, I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. What was interesting as well, he's on Top of the Pops 2 at the moment, which he's still on BBC 3 or 4, I can't think which channel, and I love watching it, and it's around 1988 at the moment. And it's a really interesting time to sort of see how historically Top of the Pops was, you know, rock and roll bands and, you know, guitars and amps and, you know, or Pan's people behind them. And then with the sort of evolution of electronic music and rave culture, they didn't seem to know what to do. And it was like, right, okay, so we're going to have to give this guy like a keytar, and he's going to have to sort of pretend to do that. And, you know, otherwise we've just got two guys standing behind synths. And well, like, this
wasn't a problem for just for Top of the Pops. It was a problem for the industry as a whole, a head scratching. What are all of these records about? What do we do with these records? For the major record labels, it was a kind of, how the fuck are these records just turning up at number 7 or 4 in the chart, and we've not heard them. We've not heard them on radio. They've not, and I got a few calls at the time, actually, when we were having that run of, you know, big smashes at XL, starting off, I suppose, with sort of top 15 records like Anastasia by T99, Cubic 22, Night in Motion, and then it became bigger records, all of the Prodigy stuff and SL2. And and I got calls from guys that I knew at major record labels saying, "Ah, Nick, yeah, I'm just calling up, check in, see how you're doing." "Oh, well, I'm fine, thanks." "Yeah, no, well done on whatever record had gone in at number three." "Oh, cheers, man." And then it would be, yeah, I was just wondering, what do you think kind of helped with that? Was it the video that was important, or did you get much radio?" You know, these were major label guys basically going, roughly translated, "How the fuck is this happening?"
Yeah.
How on earth are these records exploding? We are literally sat in our offices scratching our head trying to figure out how this thing is happening.
So I'm presuming you're getting these messages from sort of major labels that have huge marketing teams and structure, and you've got this exciting new independent label that's romping the charts.
Absolutely.
It's fucking punk rock again, isn't it?
It was indeed, because these records were not coming through the traditional system. There was something incredibly exciting about that you could have a big hit record without daytime playlists and without a video that was featured on, the main programs. It really was, power to the people, so to speak, that with the right record, that those who were tapped into this exploding scene, that alone could deliver your record, into the higher reaches of the chart. And these could be records that had been made by a kid in a bedroom, and maybe the label had only paid £1,000 or £1,500 to sign the record. And then, 12, 15 weeks later, it could be sat at number two. It was a very exciting period, there's no doubt about it.
And, I can see the Prodigy poster over your shoulder, and it'd be criminal not to say that, looking back then at bands and Top of the Pops, how they would sort of struggle as to how they can make, these chart bothering dance records a visual spectacle and not just a couple of guys with it. I mean, if there was ever a template as to go from that to festival headlining, one of the most spectacular visual things you will ever see is the Prodigy live. And it's not just, the Chemical Brothers do things amazingly with visuals and things like that, but Prodigy just rewrote it. They took dance music to rock festivals, and it's that's something that's very, very impressive.
Yeah, and they never did Top of the Pops, interestingly. We're talking about Top of the Pops. So whilst I was happy to bounce around behind a keyboard when Kicks Like Mule were top 10, the Prodigy view was, it's not something that we want to do, so we're not going to do it, even though everybody else is doing it, and even though we know that our records potentially would be bigger, and hey, maybe we would have had a number one record with a record that sat at number two. That's fine, because we don't want to do it, and that's part. That was part of the template as well of an artist knowing what they're about, knowing what's right for them, doing what's right for them, sticking to their guns.
I think that's something to this day it comes across that they do their thing, and that's their thing. Okay. Track three, Nick. The song that reminds you of your time at school.
Yes. So when I was, we'll go back to Portishead here. So I was in the Midlands when I was junior school, infant school age, I suppose. And then I moved to Portishead when I was maybe about, let's think, was I 10 years old maybe then? Something around that, I guess. It was when I was going to school in Portishead that I first found myself in an environment where there were DJs who were playing records and had flashing lights and all of that. It was the school disco, which was delivered by always school discos were run by this mobile disco setup called Crazy Psychedelic Shack. And Myself and my best mate, Andy Smith, who I now run Reach Up with, and Andy went on to provide samples for Porter's Head, which is Jeff Barrow, who's a couple of years younger than us at school. And Andy did world tours with that band and went on to do his Document Mix album series and loads of stuff. But anyway, when we were both kids, we would stand there near to the decks when Crazy Psychedelic Shack would do the mobile disco thing. And we would, you know, see them queue up records, that thing where you put the needle in the groove of a piece of vinyl and wind it forwards, wind it backwards. And we were just kind of a bit mesmerized by how that whole thing worked. We just were trying to figure out what was going on. They actually, rather than a pair of traditional headphones with two kind of cans that you put over each ear, they queued up their records on an old telephone handset. So a thing that, like, you hold in one hand and one thing goes to your ear and one thing goes to your mouth.
They used to Mark Moore from S-Express still uses that to this day.
Yes. So they used to use that to queue up their records. And when Andy and I first saw them with that thing, and we were like, so what's he doing? Because we didn't know that you queued up records, and we didn't know that something like that telephone thing, could be used to figure out where the start of a record is. And we'd be like, the guy's on the phone. And he's DJ. We're like, what is he doing on the phone? And the only thing we could think of was, is it some sort of close, you know, sort of proximity, almost like a walkie-talkie? Is it like a thing where he's asking somebody who's outside in the van to bring in some more, you know, Depeche Mode or something? Oh, you know, is he saying, we've had somebody who's requested Depeche Mode and haven't got any here, can you bring some more in from the van? We didn't know. But then we figured out, oh, that they're queuing up records, and the guys who run that club, sorry, that mobile disco, explained to us what they were doing. And we even got to sort of practice queuing up a couple of records. So all of that engagement was our first, you know, exposure to what it's like to be in an environment where people are DJing, and there's flashing lights and there's a dance floor full of punters. And we loved it, and we were hooked. Funnily enough, my best mate Andy had a big birthday celebration a couple of years ago, and he managed to get hold of Crazy Psychedelic Shack, and he had his birthday celebrations in the common room at our old comprehensive school that we went to, and the guys played, and
Andy superb.
And he queued up the same record that he'd queued up on their turntables as an 11-year-old or something, all of these decades later, and it was lovely, man. So yeah, that was a superb way to celebrate a big birthday. And the record that I've picked that reminds me of school and school discos and Crazy Psychedelic Shack is Michael Jackson, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. And the reason I picked this is that as people filtered into the school common room, you know, ahead of a or whilst the school disco started, it would kind of get busier and get busier, and the guys would just have their music on at kind of half volume level as people milled around. And then it got to that point where there was enough people in the room that Crazy Psychedelic Shack thought, yeah, right, time to, let's have it now. And then they put on a sort of countdown jingle. They'd have a couple of pyrotechnics that would explode, and then it would slam into the front end of Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, and suddenly the dance floor would just be packed instantly in a click of the fingers. And so when I hear this record, I always think of that. So let's...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Yeah, that's the one I've chosen.
That's wonderful, Nick. And whatever people's opinions are on Michael Jackson, separating the man from the music, that track, I think, is one of the greatest dance records ever made.
And, it is.
And that... the edited version at the beginning without the kind of the longer intro, as soon as you hear that whoop, and yep. Then I think it's one of the greatest intros ever. It is just...
it is.
You can't not dance. It just gets you. It's just perfect. Absolute perfect.
It is. Well, I could have had that one as best intro as well, but then I wouldn't have had this story to tell about school days, would I? So I had to save this one for the school days bit.
Oh, it's brilliant. Brilliant. What did you want to be at school, Nick?
I mean, I was into football originally, and then, like so many sort of young boys, I guess, football's your thing, and then you end up flipping across to music, really. And obviously, sometimes the football passion remains in parallel, or sometimes the football thing disappears a little bit as music takes over. So I had a phase where I was very keen on football. And then from 12, 13, 14, 15, I was really getting into music. When I was at school, I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if I could work in radio, maybe as a sort of radio DJ, or records, maybe some kind of being a record promoter or working for a record label. So I had the music bug pretty heavily through my teens. So again, I think I was fortunate in the fact that I knew it was my passion at a pretty early age. And then I was able to sort of follow that passion by doing a bunch of stuff when I was at school, when I was at uni, that all linked into it. And I think all of that stuff meant that when I then left uni, I went to Goldsmiths College, did a communications and sociology degree. I mean, to be honest, the way that my interest in music shaped my studies was profound, in the sense that I only applied to unis in London. I just figured I don't want to be in Newcastle or Glasgow or Brighton, because there aren't any big radio stations based there and record labels and big magazines. I want to be in London, where Radio One is and where all of the
opportunities.
Record labels. Yeah, you know, so I kind of figured I only want to study in London, and then I got a place at uni in London. And then that meant I could do other stuff, run club nights and, you know, kind of help out, you know, intern. I kind of helped out at Radio One, actually, when I was at uni. I kind of was a member of a thing called the Pop Panel Sunday mornings on Radio One, reviewing records. I kind of blagged my way into. In answer to your question, yes, it was music in some shape or form, but I didn't quite know. And then I think when I left uni, I was thinking it would be great if I could get something in either radio or records and see what happens. And perhaps my first job that I got offered was as like a junior record librarian or something at Capital, maybe I would have really gone down the radio line. But I was the first proper job I got offered was doing dance music promotion kind of working on club and radio for an independent promotion company called Secret Promotion. So then I found myself in the records kind of lane and stuck with it.
Okay. Track four, you mentioned The Suite earlier, but as the first single you bought from a record store. Can you remember any others that you bought for track four?
I mean, I've bought plenty of records over the years. Remind me what track four is.
Track four is the first song that you bought from a record store.
Oh, gosh, that was The Suite.
Yeah.
Because it was. I've answered two questions in one, haven't I?
That's fine.
The emotional impact and the first song. I mean, so I would say, that if we're looking for interesting stories, we should move on more on to. Did you want to do something about clubbing years?
All day long, Nick. This is what I've been looking forward to this one. So for track five, Nick, the song that soundtracked your years in clubland, which it's interesting because for so many guests that I have on that are musicians, they go, "Whoa, blimey, you know, that was in the 90s I was doing." It's like, you ain't stopped, so you're still there.
Yeah, which makes it a tricky one to answer. Yeah, because, I mean, like we talked about lockdown, I mean, I've been in and out of clubs all the way through decade on decade. So yeah, sum up, pick a tune from your clubbing era. What, you mean the era between 14 years old and 52? Pretty funny. Well, the track that I picked here is one that perhaps reflects the most intense clubbing era that I had, but not clubbing as a punter, but being in nightclubs as a DJ. So between, let's think, the first and second year of uni, in the summer holidays, I went out to Magaluf in Mallorca, and I got a job DJing in a bar, first of all, in a little bar, which in its own right was quite entertaining, because I don't think this place had a dancing license. So I would DJ in this bar, and I'd be getting the music whacked up, and people be dancing on the tables and standing on the bar and all of this. And then the guy who owned it would keep looking over his shoulder nervously out the window while all this was going on. And then presumably what would happen is occasionally maybe a local councillor or a local police person or something would wander by. And then he'd come over to me and go, no, Nick, you must go. And he'd usher me into this sort of stock room where all the crates of beer were. And I'd hide in the stock room whilst he then... where everybody would get down off the tables in the bar and he would play some music at sort of half volume and people would scratch their head and go, what? Oh, okay. And some would drift off out or some would just go sit down, have a quiet drink. And then presumably it was the local councillor or something was like, oh, right, that's fine. Everything's in order there, and would disappear off again. About 5 minutes later, he'd come back into the stockroom. Nick, okay, now you go again. You know, I'd come out. Start cranking out, everybody get back up on the tables and start dancing on the bar again. So that was the first gig in Mallorca, in Magaluf. But then, it was a bar rather than the club. And I'd been there for a couple of weeks, and then I got offered a job at a big club called Tokyo Joe's. And Tokyo Joe's was quite appealing because, one, the music that was generally played there was kind of more... really dance based, so it was funk and kind of early house, and some some early rap records was the kind of soundtrack they expected, and it was a proper club, so people could properly dance all night, and the owner didn't stick me in the stock room at any point. But what it meant was that I DJ'd there from probably 10 or 10:30 at night through till 6 a.m. every night of the week for months. And I probably did about 86 nights or something in a row DJing at this place. And, you know, I was, when you DJ 86 nights in a row or whatever it was for approximately 8 hours a night, you are putting records on in your sleep. You are waking up thinking that you need to put another record on because it's such a, you know, such a dominating part of your life. But you learn a lot from it. And what I learned there was that, you know, the big tunes of the day, if you want to keep the club full, then you play them three times a night. It, you know, it's a very different skill. It's not one of these, it's not like the skill of a DJ who just turns up for an hour and blasts out the big tunes and then disappears. This is a skill that, that resident DJs in clubs and bars all over the world have learnt. Like, hey, okay, people are coming in, it's getting a bit busier. Yeah, I'll play the big record now. It's 11:30 and it should get a load of people on the dance floor. And then because it's a big record, you know, come 2:30 in the morning, if a few people are starting to thin out, I need to draw for that record again. And probably when it reaches 5:30 a.m. and you're trying to keep the stragglers still there, you pull it out again. So this one record I seem to play at least two or three times a night for most of this summer of DJing in Tokyo Joe's in Magaluf. And I've picked out New Shoes. I Just Can't Wait, which is a record that still, I still have the same bit of vinyl that I played in that summer in the 80s. And it's got, you know, it's a piece of vinyl that's got played at Reach Up club nights in Berlin and Lisbon and in the Bussy building. And
they were German, weren't they, New Shoes?
You what? Do you know?
Were they German New Shoes? I think they were.
Possibly Dutch. Dutch or
maybe.
German. One
maybe.
Of the two. Yeah, one of the two.
What a record.
Yeah, it's a great record, isn't it? And but it's funny that same record that got all of that kind of play there still is something that I carry around with me, you know, doing the Reach Up stuff. But actually it goes further back than that, though. So whilst I play the New Shoes thing, I mean, there's records that Andy Smith and I, going back to the other anecdote, there's records that we bought as 15-year-olds, you know, going into Bristol on a Saturday afternoon, going around the record stores, and we might have bought Brothers Johnson Stomp or some Earth, Wind & Fire thing or Above and Beyond by Edgar Winter or whatever. These records that we bought as, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds. And those records we've been supporting and playing at our sort of roving club nights over the last few years. So it's crazy, isn't it?
It's wonderful. And while we're talking hometowns, for track six, Nick's, your favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Yeah. So growing up in Portishead, we were... yeah, kind of maybe a half hour drive or so outside of Bristol. So Bristol was where we would go to on the bus to look around the shops and then would to go to some gigs and club nights and all the rest of it. And there is a lot of great music that's come out of the West Country and Bristol in particular. I worked on some West Country music when I started at Secret Promotion. So I was working on Smith & Mighty, who had a couple of big kind of down-tempo cover version records, neither of which were big pop hits, but they were big records at the time, Walk On and Anyone. And I've picked another Bristol act for this. I've not picked a Portishead record, even though that's very, very close to home. But I've picked Unfinished Sympathy by Massive Attack, which is a big favourite for many. And it's a thing of real beauty. Still sounds amazing. It's timeless. It's going to sound amazing in 10 or 20 years or 40 years time if we're all still around. Or maybe it'll be a bunch of cyborg robots listening to it at that point. Who knows? In a bit of tumbleweed. But yeah, a great record from close to home. That's why I decided that I would pick that one.
I think it's as close to a perfect record as you can get. And I think I mentioned it the other day when I was recording one of these, that so few bands have this one song that sounds quite different to the rest of their catalogue of works, but just refuses to date. It just still sounds as fresh today as it did then. And yeah, and I an incredible band, but that moment and Sharon Nelson's vocal is just wonderful.
It is. Isn't it amazing how some records still manage to sound futuristic when you listen to them 40 years after they've been made? How does that work?
Nick, that's the conversation I was having. That is exactly the conversation I was having. And I referenced Fool's Gold by the Stone Roses. I mentioned How Soon Is Now by the Smiths. Like, these songs don't sound like their other works, yet they just sound like they're from out of time from somewhere. And it's brilliant.
Some of the records that I think of when I think of records that still in some way sound futuristic. So I Feel Love, Donna Summer.
I mean, that comes from outer space, that record. No one on this planet made that. Impossible.
Amazing, isn't it? And then you listen to Kraftwerk, you know, Autobahn or something from 1974 or whatever it was, and you're like, are you joking? Are you kidding me? This was made in 1973, 74? It is astonishing. But so, that's, you know.
So what I like to do on this podcast is obviously talk to guests about the songs that have soundtracked their lives. You've just mentioned Marodo and Donna Summer there with I Feel Love, and you've obviously mentioned Kraftwerk, pioneers of, you know, electronic music. And so it seems like a good point to mention the podcast that you and Eddie do.
Yeah, so that's Trailblazers, Electronic Pioneers. And then depending on when exactly this recording kind of goes out, we're probably at the time that listeners are hearing this, it's either the new series is probably just about to drop or is just started. And that's our third series. And we've got some excellent guests in this third series. So we speak to Trevor Horn, for example. So that's an interesting conversation where we're talking about Frankie Goes to Hollywood with him and ABC. And also the Malcolm McLaren records.
I mean, all landmark productions there.
Yeah. So that's an enjoyable one. James Lavelle is in there, a guy who's also got astonishing, you know, history. And Arthur Baker also. So he obviously produced the Rocker's Revenge, Walking on Sunshine, and Planet Rock.
Freeze.
So yeah, that's right. IOU. So
a new order.
Yes. So we're blessed with our guests in the new series of Trailblazers, and we've been blessed with the guests in the episodes that led up to the new series with some amazing conversations. And if you haven't heard the podcast, they're all out there, and there's some really cool conversations that we had with people like Fatboy Slim, Goldie, Paul Oakenfold, etc. And yes, you're right. It's myself and Eddie Temple Morris, so it's a nice kind of triangular conversation. The conversations don't seem to be as formal as some one-to-one interviews are.
Yeah,
the conversation can kind of be a bit more fluid, and somebody can say something about Berlin, and then somebody else will go, oh, actually, I was in Berlin a couple of years ago and this happened. And really nice, really enjoyable conversations. But also, it's an archive of people who aren't going to be around forever.
100%.
So it's something we enjoy doing, and we hope that the Trailblazers podcast will act as a really useful resource if in 5 years, 10 years' time, people go, yeah, I want to dig more into this whole electronic music thing and find out who did what and when. Hopefully there'll be a lot of interesting stuff that people can discover.
And I'll say that, without blowing too much smoke up yours and Eddie's backsides, it was a big influence on this podcast. It's one of my favourite podcasts to listen to, and I knew Eddie, and I'd not met you until I'd heard Trailblazers, and we We met through Scroob, and I think I said to you when I listened to the first series that the Daniel Miller episode knocked me sideways. It was fascinating. And the one that really surprised me was someone whose body of work I thought was just the M people. And when I listened to that, I was like, oh my God, like this guy that I dismissed as not being a fan of the M people, I was like, I'm not really, I'll give this one a spin. And it was probably my favourite episode.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, so that's the Mike Pickering episode. What is interesting is that so many people have so many interesting stories and are much more than just the headlines.
Yeah.
And that's why it's endlessly fascinating for me to talk to people, not just in music, but in all areas, because I always find out interesting stuff, because people have experienced so many things. You can just take the view. You know, let's say you get into an Uber, you can go, hey, I want to get to A to B, from A to B, and that's why I'm in the Uber. So I'm just going to get from A to B and focus on my journey, and that's it. But equally, sometimes it's an opportunity to learn all kinds of stuff, learn about what it's like to experience war in Afghanistan, or learn what it's like to move to wherever as a kid, and this, that, all sorts of crazy stuff that people have experienced. And you know, people have fascinating stories, and that's great that on Mike Pickering that you were able to learn so much more about him, because of course you just thought, it's the M people going, I'm not into M people, maybe kind of dismissed it, but that's a guy who's done amazing things. And it's one of the great pleasures of my life, meeting new people, learning about them, talking to them. And I'm kind of working on some new podcast initiatives at the moment that will hopefully give me some more interesting conversations over months and years to come.
100%. Mm. Well, let's go back to Nick Hawks, the DJ. For track 7, it's your opportunity to play somebody a song that they may not know that you would like them to hear.
Yes. I mean, this is a tough one as well, because how many really good records are there out there that the majority of the population just haven't heard? Many, because it's hard to get people's attention. It's hard to get people's ears across new music. Everybody's busy. I mean, this lockdown period has been different, because at least we know that people have primarily been at home. And haven't been jetting around or busy rushing to out of their homes. But then again, during lockdown, there's been people who've been up to their eyeballs parenting young children and still have not had the time to listen to new music in the way that maybe they would have liked to. So very difficult choice of all of the records that are out there. There's one wonderful record from a Grammy nominated artist that I manage called Engineers Experiment, and myself and Stephen Brains manage Engineers Experiment, a name that perhaps is not known to most listeners. There's a wonderful record called Symbol, and there's a track on this album which is called Light From One, and it's one of the most beautiful pieces of music that I know, but most people don't know it. So I thought I'd pick something that was a record that I've worked on, and I've worked with the artist, but it kind of goes to show that there can be artists that one can work with, and you can have big success and everybody knows those records. And then you can also work hard with other artists and the records just don't find their way through. And that's the nature of the music industry. And it's something that we have to accept working in the music industry, that there will always be great records that don't get the level of attention that they deserve. That's just part of it. So the record that I thought I'd play is Light From One, featuring Anne Brun. It's by Engineers Experiment.
Wonderful. Well, will there be a Spotify playlist accompanying this podcast with all of the songs that that you've chosen? And we'll throw some of the other ones in that we've spoke about as well.
Yeah.
And so Trailblazers weekly podcast?
Yes, that's right. So a new episode each week for the duration of this new series. If people want to find out kind of what's happening in a bit more detail, where are we at, what's the next one, all the rest of it, then they could follow me on my socials, Nick Hawkes, NickHalkes on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and then I'm usually posting some clips of the episode that comes next.
I'll tag you and Eddie in all the posts when this goes out as well. So
brilliant,
will be able to access it all. And I'm sure there'll be some love shared via Pod Bible as well, because it is a podcast that, as I said when I first met you, I'm a big fan of. So it's
brilliant. Well, thanks for your support, man. We appreciate that.
It's a pleasure to sit and talk to you. Thanks ever so much, Nick.
It's been great. You take care, Stu, and I'll speak soon.
A lot of great stories, and we could have chatted for hours. I've spoke to Nick. He guested on the Hardcore Listening podcast that I do with Chris Glasson, and I mean, I'd recommend you go and listen to that as well, because over on there, we really go into his kind of formative years as a club promoter, and some of the things that he was doing in Ibiza are just real maverick moves, and you can see someone had a real eye for being in the right place at the right time and doing the right thing. And go and check out Trailblazers. It's such a good podcast, and as mentioned, the Mike Pickering episode and the Daniel Miller episode, I can't recommend them enough. Just go and have a little route around, because it really is a who's who of electronic music. Okay, right, I'll be back next week. If you can't wait till then, why not go and check out my Patreon page? There's an Off the Beaten Track Patreon, so go over there, and there's over 100 unique episodes over there as well, and you can support the podcast by signing up over there. And also, just subscribe. Subscribe on iTunes or on whatever platform you listen to, and then that way, each week, your little episode of Off the Beaten Track, and my lispy voice will just automatically find its way onto your listening device. Listening, that's an odd word to say of a lisp. See you next time. Mind there you go. Stay safe. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a lot of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. PodBibleMag.com. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.